When the young William Basie landed in Kansas City in the late 1920s, pianist Benny Moten's band was the toast of the town.
Swing. Truly, that's what Benny Moten was playing, was swing. I don't know whether he called it Western style or not, but he had a beat. It was real foot patting.
This new sound captivated Basie. He'd been in Harlem with Fats Waller and the Stride Piano Giants. In Kansas City, Benny Moten was in command. But Kansas City would soon be Basie's town. This hour, we retrace the remarkable personal and musical journey Count Basie took in the months following the death of Benny Moten in 1935. I'm Nancy Wilson. It's Count Basie, the man and his music, on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Throughout his life, Count Basie had a knack of being at the right place at the right time. As soon as he left his childhood home of Red Bank, New Jersey, he arrived in Harlem, where he met pianist Thomas Fats Waller in the middle of the Stride Piano Revolution.
The main guy that really influenced me was Thomas Fats Waller. That was the man that I really did idolize.
And when he arrived in Kansas City in the late 1920s, he was again in the right place at the right time. Historian Dan Morgenstern.
Stride piano is wonderful, but it doesn't have a very strong blues element. But that all comes together in Kansas City. And the transition from 1920s jazz to swing is one where Kansas City is really critical. Moten Swing is like the anthem of Kansas City swing. The first really swinging 4/4 jazz that you hear comes out of the Benny Moten band at its late brilliant climax. Basie's in the band, Hot Lips Page, young Ben Webster, Eddie Durham, Eddie Bearfield, Walter Page. Hey, what a band. There's one that I love above all others, the recording of Moten Swing, where the tempo and the groove they get is something that's so special, and that gives you a hint of what that band could do in person. They play for dancing, and that was such an important element in the development of the music. We tend to forget that today. The relationship between the dancers and the musicians was essential.
In Kansas City, Benny Moten could make everybody dance. Basie biographer Albert Murray.
Benny Moten was one of the top guys with political clout and therefore economic clout. His first love was music. And his ambition, of course, was to get into the big league. They didn't ever make it.
It's quite a miracle that Benny Moten band gets to make those wonderful records in 1932. The things they had to go through, they didn't get paid and they had nothing to eat. Somebody catches some rabbits and they cook this rabbit stew on the bus. But it sounds pretty good, the rabbit stew.
Saxophonist Eddie Bearfield.
Benny took us over to Camden, New Jersey, took us to a pool hall, and this guy took a tub and took one rabbit and made a big stew. We got bread, a lot of bread, and stood around and sopped up this stew and ate this gravy. I always called it cat stew because I didn't figure out where this guy got this rabbit.
With the Camden record date, Benny Moten was positioned for great things, but tragedy struck him, and that spelled opportunity for Basie. Albert Murray.
It was April Fool's Day that he died. I was in Mobile. This is 1935. I was a senior in high school.
Producer Orrin Keep News.
Basie and the band leader were piano players. He didn't exactly, in so many words, take over the band. It's more complicated than that. After a period of time, there was the initial Basie band.
From nearly the very beginning, Count Basie's band took the music world by storm, and he would lead a band over the remainder of his life. What was the secret of his success? Veteran Basie saxophonist Frank Foster.
When he first went to Kansas City and he heard this happy music, that feeling just osmosed into him and he osmosed it back.
Yeah. I'm Nancy Wilson with a special edition of Jazz Profiles. Count Basie's World celebrates the centennial of an American legend. This hour, it's the man and his music. Your host is Avery Brooks.
With the Benny Moten Band at a crossroads due to the death of its leader, the young Bill Basie faced his own dilemma regarding his future. Whatever he was thinking, he couldn't have imagined what would lie ahead for him in wide-open Kansas City.
South Texas and losing up. They come through Kansas City and change the style, because anytime you tell somebody you're from Kansas City, they know that you're a good musician. The Kansas City style was different from any of the styles. Get the Kansas City stamp, you got it made.
If he had to be in limbo, Kansas City was the perfect place to be. For a risk taker like Basie, the abundance of musicians and the fertile musical atmosphere inspired him.
It was really jumping. The way it was with me, I never knew when to go to bed because I was afraid I would miss something. And I'd have to make myself go to bed, which would be about 11 or 12 o'clock in the day, and then I'd be up at 7 o'clock back out to see what was happening, you know.
I'm Avery Brooks. This hour, we retrace the remarkable personal and musical journey Count Basie took in the months following the death of Benny Moten in Missouri in 1935. It was a journey that would lead him out of the jazz and blues clubs of Kansas City and on to the world stage. From the beginning, Count Basie's band developed a reputation for itself for its capacity to swing hard. Everyone agreed. The big band was special, its conception unique, its rhythm section unmatched, and it quickly became a magnet for many of the greatest soloists of the day. In all of American musical history, no big band would ever duplicate the accomplishments of the Count Basie Orchestra of the 1930s and early 40s. And along the way, Basie was transformed from Bill Basie, journeyman pianist, to Count Basie, band leader and American folk hero. I'm Avery Brooks. Welcome to Count Basie, the man and his music. Lauren Schoenberg is the director of the Harlem Jazz Museum in New York City.
In America, with our value system, new is better than old. And I don't like anything about that Basie band of the 30s being characterized as old, because that's new, and that's fresh, and that's risk-taking, and that's Basie as a creative piano player creating. He was a living, breathing, improvisational madman at that piano. He played all kinds of crazy things, and he was in the middle of it. Basie had this very self-effacing manner, but he was clearly a driven man, and one does not become a big band leader by being self-effacing or aw shucks. He was, from all accounts, a very sweet and soft-spoken man, but clearly he was a man with great ambition.
Moten had position, and he had lofty ambitions too, and both were lost with his death. In the aftermath, the atmosphere within the band was just not the same, and Basie left to pursue his own vision. It turned out to be a good move, as he quickly secured his first gig as a band leader in Kansas City, at the Reno Club. Count Basie himself.
Reno was in 12th and Sherry. It was fun. That's where everything started for me, right there in that little club.
Claude Fiddler Williams was there.
I knew Count in Kansas City way before he had a chance to get in a group together. The blues that was band had just broke up too. So Count picked out a rhythm section and on two saxophones and was playing there at this Reno club in Kansas City.
Bassist Walter Page was known to everyone as Biggin. He joined Basie, and after some time, drummer Joe Jones joined the band at the Reno. When Joe arrived to join Walter Page and Basie, the piano, bass, and drums formed a swinging nucleus. Schoenberg.
Walter Page was like Frank Morgan in The Wizard of Oz. He was the power behind the Basie throne. I mean, the whole concept came from Walter Page. Page made them play so quietly and get that blend. And they created this great magic carpet, that's how I like to think about it, for the other soloists.
Tenor saxophonist Jerry Jerome was in Kansas City with the Harry James Orchestra. One night, he met up with pianist Mary Lou Williams.
She took me to the Reno Club. I walked in there. If there's any way of describing what a ventriloquist dummy that's on a rod can do when his head goes like that, you can spin it around. I heard Lester Young and this Basie group, no music on the stand, just playing charts. I just went crazy listening to that band. They went all night, and Lips Page was the master of ceremonies. He would introduce the stars that would come in, not just players, but dancers, singers, And they had a balcony with all the rich white people would sit with these beautiful hats, the ladies would sip Perno and just get out of their heads, you know, listening to this good music. It's just a sort of a orgiastic kind of a thing. And the music turned everybody on.
The rhythm section at the Reno freed Basie to concentrate on tempos, and that approach set the music free. Trumpeter Clark Terry.
Basie was the king of motherwit as far as tempo. He taught us all the greatest lesson in the world, and that is the utilization of space and time.
Wanna see my baby, man. I want to see my baby bear. That's the sweetest woman that I've ever had.
Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
Blues and boogie-woogie become essential elements in the Basie band as it develops. That is what equips him then to become a band leader in his own right. One of the things about Basie is that he understands how important it is to retain the kind of looseness and spontaneity that is so essential to great jazz and combine that with the necessary discipline that is required when you have a big band, which has to play something more than just stuff that's made up on the spot. He manages to do that. It doesn't come overnight, because when you hear the very earliest Basie band records, they're rough spots, but the concept is there, and it's that concept that Basie has, which is so unique and phenomenal.
It didn't take long for the scene at the Reno to become big news, and a local radio station, W9XBY, began broadcasting nightly from the Reno Club. It could be heard in Chicago and beyond. Tenor saxophonist Lester Young heard the band from Minneapolis, and the sound he heard made him rush to Kansas City to replace saxophonist Slim Freeman. Producer Orrin Keep News.
Radio had begun in the mid-30s to come into its own. The part of radio that was most intriguing, there were late-night broadcasts from the venues that these bands were playing at. When you got into the late night, there were a lot fewer stations on the air.
Violinist Claude Fiddler Williams heard the Reno broadcasts.
I never will forget the W9XBY. They broadcast every night from 12:30 to 1. Don Hammonds checked in. He went down Kansas City and listened to it.
I put on the set one night, and I was fiddling on the dial and all the way over at 1550 on the dial. I came across a station in Kansas City called W9XBY. So I listened to some music. I couldn't imagine. I thought I knew all the bands in the country, you see. I couldn't imagine where or what this was. So the guy said, this is radio station W9XBY, experimental station in Kansas City, Missouri. We are broadcasting live from the Reno Club, and we are listening to Count Basie and his orchestra.
This is Count Basie's World from NPR. I'm Avery Brooks. With the exposure generated from the new medium of radio, big bands were getting very popular. With his arrival at the Reno and the inception of broadcasts each night, Basie was at the right place at the right time. Tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans and trumpeter Buck Clayton arrived from California, and Count Basie was swinging. Dan Morgenstern.
Count Basie is the man who streamlines swing. I think it's no coincidence that the Basie Band comes roaring out of Kansas City in early 1936. That's around the same time as streamlining becomes a design concept. You have the Chrysler Dynaflow, and you have the great trains, the cross-continental railroad, the 20th century. Basie streamlines swing. All the rough edges come off, and it's almost like a streamlined train barreling along. That band has an absolutely unique feeling to it of swing. There's nothing that swings more than the Basie Band.
Inspired by his success at the Reno Club in Kansas City. In 1936, booking agent Willett Alexander and John Hammond decided to expand the band from 8 to 13 pieces and take it on the road. There were stops at the Grand Terrace in Chicago and Christmas week at the Roseland Ballroom in New York. In Kansas City, Basie was the biggest name in town. In New York, they were just another band trying to make it. Dan Morgenstern.
When they come to New York at first, they come to the Roseland, and they really don't do too well there. They kind of bomb there because the band is not really together yet, and they don't have a big book as yet.
One review was particularly scathing. If you don't believe the band is out of tune, just listen to the reed section. If you don't believe the reed section is out of tune, just listen to the brass section. And if you don't believe that, just listen to the band. The reception wasn't much different just weeks earlier in Chicago at the Grand Terrace.
Fletcher Henderson lends them some arrangements which they adapt as best they can to their style. At the Grand Terrace, they have to play for a complicated stage show with chorus girls and dancers and singers, and they bomb. They can't really cut it, but they make their way.
It might have been that audiences were not yet ready for the level of sophistication that Basie, Walter Page, Joe Jones, and Lester Young were attempting to pull off. Lauren Schoenberg.
I think Lester Young was the greatest artist that was in that universe. Lester Young, I think without a doubt, was, if one has to make a judgment, the greatest artist of all of them. Basie was a great piano player, and it's synergy. Basie never played better than when he was playing for Lester Young. It was just like a magical period. Some of my favorite moments are the trading between Lester Young and Count Basie that they do on Shoe Shine Boy. Version called Roseland Shuffle, where they trade back and forth for three choruses, and it's so witty, and it's so fun, and it's so fast. Basie plays something, Lester plays something, back, 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 and it just shows you how nimble Basie's mind was back in those days. Thank you. If you listen to Lady Be Good in 1936, listen to the first chorus. You hear Walter Page playing four different quarter notes. Boom, 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 boom. Page had this concept that was based in a lot of counterpoint. Walter Page was classically trained. He loved to play Bach. And he saw the construction of the bass line as this essential element that had to have a lot of contrast in it. It had to move in different ways. Then when Lester Young comes in for his solo, the rhythm section changes. Basie plays the same line on the piano. All of a sudden, there's architecture, there's form, there's structure.
Basie, it was great to be back in New York City. Lauren Schoenberg.
Can you imagine Harlem, the Christmas week, 1936? The Basie Band, they've been out in Kansas City. And I don't care how cosmopolitan Kansas City was and all the crazy things that went on there. They come to New York City. They play Roseland Ballroom opposite Woody Herman. Here they are in the big time. Basie had been to New York, but now he's the leader of the band.
John Hammond.
It was an unknown band, and people came. They were playing opposite Woody Herman at Roseland. And so there were good bands on each bandstand, and Roseland was famous for that in those days. Basie was in the tradition of being a great band in New York, and it took New York about 6 weeks to realize they had a band the like of which they had never heard before.
Guitarist Freddie Green was in New York, and when John Hammond heard him, he took Basie to hear him play, and Green replaced Claude Fiddler Williams in the band. A quintessential rhythm guitarist, Green did not solo. His pride was in providing something magical to the core rhythm section, a rock-steady pulse right on the beat. Freddie Green.
I started playing. I think I was doing some single-string thing, you know. And that's what I thought they wanted. And Hershel said, no, no, just keep some time. And I said, well, okay. I start playing, just keeping time like I'm accustomed to doing, yeah. More or less. But I thought that I don't want to lose this job, you know what I mean? So I started playing rhythm ever since.
Hammond didn't hide his enthusiasm about Basie, and it cost him. Dan Morgenstern.
One of the things that John could have kicked himself for and did was that he didn't quickly enough sign Basie to the label that he was connected with, which is the American Record Company, which is Brunswick and Vocalion, and later, when it was revived, Columbia.
Jack Kapp of Decca Records signed Basie to his first recording contract. They went into the studio to record during the first half of 1937.
John liked to talk, so he was talking up this great band. So Jack Kapp likes what he hears, so he signs Basie to a contract to Decca, which was still a fairly young label. founded in 1934, based on the concept of selling records for 35 cents rather than 75 cents with major artists. Big success. He signs Basie to a contract which, according to Hammond, was far from being what it should have been in terms of royalties and so on. But you've got to say this for Cap, he gets the band out there, they record, and the records are well distributed, and the records are great. 1 o'clock jump.
According to Hammond, for recording the first 24 songs, Basie was paid $750. 1 o'clock jump was one of the tunes Basie picked to record for the date, and it was the first Basie record to become a hit. It eventually replaced Moton Swing as the band's theme song. Lauren Schoenberg.
When they first came to New York and made those early records for Decca, Honeysuckle Rose and Boo Hoo and Exactly Like You and all those records, they did not know that they were going to be the famous Count Basie band. At that point, the chances were much more in favor of them becoming like most bands that came to New York and didn't make it. And they made a few records and they went back to where they came from. And nobody knew when Basie counted off the 1 o'clock jump that day in July 1937. That record would become one of the most played records of all time.
Basie, 1936 and the first half of 37 had been a whirlwind. With a hit record and radio exposure, he was on his way to becoming a household name alongside Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Benny Goodman. Like the Kansas City of the early 30s, New York was the perfect environment for Basie to grow, and he took advantage of the opportunities. More New York success lay ahead, but there would be setbacks as well. Setbacks that would test Basie's resolve. I'm Avery Brooks. We'll explore that and much more as Count Basie, The Man and His Music, continues.
Thank you.
With the arrival of 1 o'clock Jump, the Count Basie Band had an established sound that made it different from all other bands. And with the arrival of Lester Young and Herschel Evans, the sound got more unique. Lauren Schoenberg is the director of the Harlem Jazz Museum in New York City.
The Basie Band of the 30s was known as the first band that featured two tenor saxophones. Before that, all the bands had one great tenor player, but there had never been a major band that went out there featuring not one, but two great tenors.
Veteran Basie tenor saxophonist Illinois Jacquet.
This was the most exciting thing in jazz music I'd ever heard of, and everyone took solos. The saxophone battle was a new trend in jazz music. Every saxophone player in the world wanted it to be like that, including me.
In his earliest days with the Blue Devils, singer and showman Jimmy Rushing had been associated with Basie. Everyone loved Jimmy Rushing.
1927, I came in from California. All the bands had rhythm. People were really dancing to all of the old good tunes.
Dan Morgenstern is the director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
Jimmy Rushing was the ideal male singer for that band because he could sing some great blues, but he didn't want to be typecast. Well, some of the things he recorded with the band were Pennies from Heaven, Exactly Like You. He could sing anything and liked to sing anything. He had this wonderful high tenor and great time.
Don't the moon look lonesome shining through the trees? Don't the moon look lonesome shining through the trees? Don't your house look lonesome when your baby back up to leave? Sent for you yesterday and here you come today. Sent for you yesterday and here you come today. You can't love me, baby, and treat me that way.
In March of 1937, Basie went to the Apollo Theater in New York, and he would meet legend in the making.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never.
And then there was Billie Holiday. Billy, of course, was already a stylist, and the arrangements, at least what survives, what we are able to hear, were pretty much tailored to her. So we have You Can't Take That Away From Me.
The way you hold your knife, the way we dance till three, the way you change my life.
And I Can't Get Started. Billy could shoot craps with the guys, and usually win, actually, on the band bus. She didn't put on airs, and that's where she and Lester Young really became very close.
I've been consulted by Franklin D. Even Basie had me to tea. But now I'm brokenhearted, can't get started with you.
I'm Avery Brooks. You're listening to Count Basie's World from NPR. Billie Holiday had a short tenure with Basie. In early 1938, she left the band. Dan Morgenstern.
After Billie came Helen Humes. She had kind of a Mildred Bailey type of voice, a rather high kind of girlish soprano. Ideally for Basie, she had wonderful time, and she was also somebody who, like Jimmy, could sing the blues and sing standards.
Where shall I go when I go where I go? Since you have sent me away, and what can I do when I do what I do? You seem to haunt me all day. Now where can I find what I found when I first met you? You were unkind, I simply can't forget you. Shall I go when I go where I go? Since you have sent me away.
Don't think of Basie doing that song, but he damn well recorded it, just as he did the thing that the Ink Spots made famous, If I Didn't Care.
If I didn't care more than words can say, if I didn't care, would I feel this way? If this isn't love, then maybe I'm wrong. But why do I lie awake all night and dream all day long? If I didn't care, would it be the same? Would my every prayer begin and end with just your name? And would I be sure that this is love beyond compare? Would all this be true if I didn't care?
At first, Helen Humes didn't want to join the Basie band.
Basie heard me, and he came over and he was talking to me, and he said, well, I certainly enjoyed your singing. He said, I'd like to have you come and sing with my band. I said, who is your band? He says, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't introduce myself. I'm Count Basie. I said, oh, well, how much do you pay? He says, I pay $35 a week. I said, oh, no. I said, I make $35 a week here, and I don't have to go no place. I don't have to travel. I'll just stay here. He said, well, we were trying to find somebody to take Billie Holiday's place, and we enjoy you. I said, well, thank you so much. But right now, I'll just stay here.
Count Basie eventually prevailed upon the young Helen Humes to join his band, and her time with him helped to establish her as an important singer. The year 1938 was a landmark year for Basie. Bookended in January and December with two Carnegie Hall appearances and a great showing at an historic Battle of the Bands with Chick Webb's orchestra on its home turf, the Savoy Ballroom. The buzz generated from that night led Basie to the Woodside Hotel in Harlem. Instead of using written music, Basie used loosely arrived at arrangements that were based on riffs or head arrangements. Saxophonist Frank Foster.
A head arrangement probably started with one idea or motif, if you will, that was expressed by one or the other sections, maybe the saxophones, like for instance, Jumping the Woodside. Ba-da-dee-da, ba-da-dee-da, ba-da-dee-da. Then the brass sort of punctuated the licks that came out of the saxophone section. Ba-da-dee-da, bop, 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 ba-da-dee-da. They interwove these things. Any section could be the source of one of these riffs or licks that was the main melodic statement in the song, and everybody else just knew how to fall in line and do something to enhance that.
When trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison joined the band, the lack of written music was a challenge.
I joined Count Basie in 1938, and we used to do 300 one-nighters a year. When I first joined the band, everybody in the Count Basie band had played with Benny Moten's band, so they all knew what they wanted to play. They all had notes to 1 o'clock jump, swinging the blues, out the window. It was a head arrangement. The brass section would get together, and they would set a riff, bass would play on the piano, the saxophone would go to another room and they would set a riff. And when we all came back to the rehearsal hall, we'd all have an arrangement.
Next for Basie, an appearance on 52nd Street. Once he arrived there, jazz fans flocked to see him in a tiny club called The Famous Door.
And that's the familiar theme music that introduces Count Basie and his orchestra, coming to you from New York's celebrated Famous Door Club in another program of America Dances, broadcast to Great Britain through the facilities of the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Dan Morgenstern.
That's the first time that the band is playing in a club with no dancers. They're just playing for people to come in and listen. And of course, they packed the joint, and they had an outlet on CBS that they were heard on the air. And it was a great, very important milestone in the career of the band.
Lauren Schoenberg.
They could swing like crazy, which is why it's fun to listen to some of those live broadcasts from The Famous Door. You can't hear them just going for broke every time.
Thank you. After 6 months at the Famous Door, Basie had it all together. He had found the right alchemy of repertoire and musicians, and he had all of America listening. Less than 3 years after leaving Kansas City, he was at the top. Basie would not have time to enjoy his place at the top of the jazz world. It would be short-lived, due to the wave of setbacks that would knock him down, but not knock him out. In 1939, saxophonist Herschel Evans died suddenly, just before his 30th birthday. The next year, saxophonist Lester Young left the band, and there was turmoil and confrontation with his booking agents. Even though Basie had signed a new recording contract with Hammond in 1939, times were changing, and not for the better. Producer Orrin Keepnews.
There you were at the tail end of the 30s, and what you had was this country coming out of the Depression primarily by virtue of the fact that there was a very big war going on. So that by the time you hit the early 40s, that big band business was in a lot of trouble. It was not easy to travel, and these were bands whose reputations and income were built on going all over the country and playing in venues in large and not so large cities all over the country. That got to be difficult to do.
By December 1941, World War II was a reality for America, and the music business took a back seat to the job of survival. The draft hit Basie when drummer Joe Jones and saxophonist Lester Young were drafted. There would be even more obstacles ahead to confront him. Changing popular tastes, the recording band of 1942, the decline of big bands, and the new medium of television a little later on. Regardless of his predicament, Count Basie was a survivor. He would go on to rise up above it all. I'm Avery Brooks. Join me next time for the conclusion of Count Basie, the man and his music.
The Count Basie Centennial Radio Project is produced by the Luce Group in association with WBGO-FM and National Public Radio. Jazz Profiles is a production of NPR. For more information, visit our website at npr.org. That's npr.org. Count Basie, the man and his music, was written and produced by Jim Luce. Our technical director is Duke Marcos. Special thanks to the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, the Hamilton College Jazz Archives, the Mar Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, the Library of Congress, the Center for Jazz Studies at Columbia University, the American Jazz Museum, the Jazz Museum of Harlem, Tracy Turner Design, and to Cephas Bowles, Dan Morgenstern, Robert O'Mealy, Chase Jackson, Wiley Rollins, Monk Rowe, Brian Belanca, Larry Applebaum, Tad Hershorn, Ben Rowe, Samantha McElhaney, and Toby Byron Multiprizes. Major support for the Count Basie Centennial Radio Project comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Hovland Company, America made audio for the home, at hovlandcompany.com. Oris Automatic Mechanical Swiss Watches at oris.ch. Small Dog Electronics, iPods and Apple Computers at smalldog.com. And Swiss International Airlines, 70 destinations worldwide at swiss.com. Support also comes from National Public Radio, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and the New Jersey Historical Commission. This is NPR, National Public Radio.